Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. It's the News Roundup, where we check in with journalists from across the region to talk about the stories making news this week. We're going to begin the hour with the No Kings protests held on Saturday, not only across our region, but of course across the country. There were around 2,000 nationwide and 100 protests across the state. Joining us to talk about the protests on the Cape and Islands is Josh Balling from Nantucket's Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Sam Houghton from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Mindy.
And CIA's John Basile. And Josh, we're going to start with Nantucket. I happened to be on Nantucket for the book festival on Saturday. I came out of dreamland, and I saw some of the protesters walking, and I thought, oh, there they go. But no, more came around the corner, and I could not believe how I couldn't even see the end. And I thought, this has to be several hundred people. But my estimation was double that, right?
It was. The estimates that we're getting were about 650 people. We had a reporter, Kai Quigley, down there covering the event, and he kind of confirmed that what the organizer was saying is that about 650 or more people showed up to march against President Trump and his administration Saturday night, and what wasn't the best of nights either. It was kind of cold, chilly, and drizzly. And it's believed to be one of the biggest, if not the biggest, sort of gathering, public gathering, protest demonstration in Nantucket's history.
Yeah, and I think the organizers of the event, they said that 97 RSVPs, so they were some kind of surprised with the
turn. They were kind of surprised. They've held three sort of No Kings protests since Trump took the oath of office for his second term, and they had somewhere between 75 and 100, 150 at each of those. So this was a big surprise. I don't know how many people actually RSVP for demonstrations
these
days.
I know. Right.
And it was a surprise.
And these were not just year-round residents. These were visitors. These were a little bit of everybody.
There was a little bit of everybody. It was really across the board. The last couple of demonstrations, and they have been, before the season really got going, were largely year-round residents, but there were definitely visitors. I know there were some attendees for the book festival. There was a lot going on the island that weekend, even despite the weather, and it did seem to attract, quite a large crowd.
Yeah, Sam, a large turnout on the Vineyard as well.
Yeah. It's hard to know exactly how many, but organizers said there was something. They claimed it was about 1,000, and I think there have been protests on the island since Trump, just like Nantucket. And we get the sense that they are growing. And I think a big reason, some of the organizers we spoke to and some of the people there confirmed it, but what they're saying is when you see kind of direct impacts from the Trump administration, that's turning more and more people out. And I think we saw that when ICE came to the island and detained something like 40 people reported on Nantucket and the Vineyard. And I think a lot of folks at this rally were saying, when you see your neighbor detained like that, and we've reported that many of these people did not have any criminal records or anything like that. And they're saying, when you see your neighbor going through something like that, it hits home. Mm-hmm. And it encouraged folks to come out. We heard from some educators at the rally who were there, actually an assistant principal from a school was there, who basically said that their schools had, the Brazilian population is really scared.
Yeah.
And this was their way of kind of, showing their support and pushing back against that idea.
Yeah. And John, you were in Hyannis, where there was also a pretty good turnout.
It was loud and crowded at the Hyannis Airport Rotary on Saturday afternoon. I spoke to a couple from Rhode Island who gave their names as Rusty and Diane.
Well, we're on vacation for the weekend, and we looked at the calendar for the protest, and we was like, we made it.
You came here from where?
Rhode Island, Newport.
Yeah. Are you surprised to see this many people out?
Yes, I am very surprised at the number. This is a vast, vast number of people, and everybody has something to say, and most of the time it is the same thing, using different words. Same meaning.
We had one guy going by us, whipping us a finger, but,
There was only one guy. Difference of opinion, freedom of speech.
I should add that Rusty was dressed as Ben Franklin, and the crowd estimate in Hyannis was, some people said 3,000. I originally estimated 2,000, but organizers said 3,000. I also spoke with Chris Yulia of Falmouth, who said she had been at earlier demonstrations in Falmouth and in Bourne.
I'm very concerned about what's happening with immigration
as far as people leaving with no due process. We're seeing it in Falmouth, we're seeing it in Martha's Vineyard. I could go on and on. I agree with what Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, and that is when justice becomes law, resistance becomes duty.
And there was one man holding a sign quoting a Bible verse.
I think that a lot of people forget the Bible. Matthew 2:13, Jesus went with his family to Egypt to flee from Herod as a refugee. And everyone kind of just forgets that.
And James Rosenblum of Harwich had a lot on his mind as well.
I cannot stand what's going on in this country. We as a country need to have free and fair elections. We need to have freedom for people. We can't have this Nazi-style ICE raids in cities. We can't have this corruption in government.
And Mindy, I have to say I was struck by the fact that there were people there with various grievances against the Trump administration. It wasn't just one idea. Some carried signs opposing the cuts to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Others, as we heard, took a religious point of view. Some were concerned with LGBTQ issues. Many were concerned about immigration policy and the way that ICE is being used.
Yeah. And Sam and Joss, I think the sentiment was pretty much the same from the folks who attended the protests on both islands. One of the things that I thought was interesting that I heard from some just people in my own circles found is everybody's felt so hopeless, right? And just helpless. And I heard a lot of people say just the turnout, not here, but across the country, is giving some people hope. And I'm wondering, Sam or Josh, have you heard that?
I think, to a degree. We talked to the organizers from Indivisible Nantucket, and that feeling of helplessness, I think, was certainly exacerbated on the islands by the ICE presence a couple of weeks ago or last month. And there was sort of, people didn't really know what to do, how to address it. They felt kind of powerless. And, coming together, again, Nantucket might have had less people at the demonstration than on the Vineyard or on the Cape, but that's a lot for Nantucket.
That is
a lot. I think
there
was certainly a feeling of, some solidarity and that they're not alone in their feelings and their thoughts moving forward.
Yeah, Sam, same thing?
Yeah, no, I think that's fair to say. I think, with the past demonstrations as well, but I think as they are growing, I think that's a fair point to make.
Yeah, and we said we had protests Eastham, Chatham, New Bedford, Fall River. I mean, I don't want to leave anybody out, but I'm sure I didn't catch everybody there. Sam, you mentioned the ICE raids, and I know that the Martha's Vineyard Times has been following up on what happened to some of those arrested in the recent ICE raid on the island. It's tough to get info. Tell us what you followed. What, three people?
Yeah, so we've been able to follow kind of the path of three that were detained, that we've been able to speak with at least all three kind of lived on the island at least for a little bit, some for a long time. So 40 people, as we were saying, detained by ICE reportedly on the Vineyard in Nantucket. The federal agency hasn't said really any details on who these are. They've given us one name. But they're the 39 or so others. They haven't exactly said what they've done or how many there were, and they've faced a lot of pressure for not being that transparent. Some of the, we were able to reach these three. They were sent to ICE, these three individuals, a holding facility in Burlington, Mass. All three kind of described this seemingly inhumane conditions. Something like 40 people packed into a 50 square foot facility, no bathroom door, no showers. They're kind of in the same clothes they were arrested in for several days, and kind of slow, meager rations. Eventually they were brought to a facility in Plymouth, county jail there. And from our understanding, they were given an option to fly back to their country of origin, or be deported. Two of them have since flown back to Brazil. They described this very long and arduous process. But one of them, who's been on the island for about 7 years, was in the process of getting his green card. He presented a work visa to ICE officials when he was arrested. He's trying to fight being deported. Mm. He has a home now in Falmouth. He just moved there where his wife lives. And he's was on the island for 6 or 7 years, and he wants to stay, and he thinks he can fight it.
And as far as you could tell, no criminal record for these three, right?
Yeah, from these three individuals, all the local courts that we looked at, no criminal records. We tried to reach officials in Brazil, but they did not provide us any information. But yeah. You know, in talking to them, they have no criminal records. All three are, you know, basically there on the island to work. Mm-hmm. And I think a really, you know, touching, you know, that kind of hit home for us is one of these guys turned 30 while he was in prison. And, you know, in his words, he was, I didn't imagine this. I came to the island to work hard and make money for my grandparents and to provide a home for my family. Yeah. And turning 30 in jail is not what he envisioned.
Yeah, a little bit later in the hour, we'll get an update on some of the ICE raids on the South Coast. But turning to some other news, Josh, Nantucket looking to ban cell phones for students at school right now. No current policy on cell phones?
No current uniform policy on cell phones. It's been sort of class by class, depending on the teachers. For several years now, a number of teachers request or require that students turn in their phones when they enter the class, and they can pick them up when they leave. But sort of in light of the cell phone bans being discussed sort of widespread nationwide and at the state level in Massachusetts in particular, the school committee has worked with administration to draft a cell phone policy. They did not approve it yet, but what it will do is it will prohibit cell phone use while students are in school. They will be provided with a lockable pouch that they have to put their cell phones in, and they cannot unlock it until they are ready to leave school. This is the sort of the next step. Again, there's no current cell phone policy. Students are often seen using their cell phones in the hallways, you know, on the school grounds, but that would also not be an option anymore. Some of the school committee members did express some concern about students not being able to reach their parents in the case of emergency. But Superintendent Beth Hallett reassured everyone at Tuesday's school committee meeting that the safety of students is always a top priority, and if students want to contact their parents during the school day, they can always call from the front office or have their phone pouch unlocked with an administrator's approval.
All right, and Sam, lots of Jaws enthusiasts from all over the place coming to the island for festivities celebrating the 50th anniversary of the film.
Yeah, no, it's, I think, fair to say it's a really exciting time on the island. I think anywhere you look, there's like a Jaws truck or the head of a shark in the back of someone's truck. But yeah, no, 50th anniversary, the film obviously shot on the island 50 years ago. And, you know, we have all kinds of stories up, but, you know, a lot of locals were part of the film 50 years ago, so it's really neat to hear from them. But obviously, it all kicks off the 50th celebration this weekend.
Yeah.
Tonight, there's a kind of a big event. And tomorrow, I think the big one, there's going to be a screening with the Cape Cod Symphony Orchestra.
Yeah, we're going to talk to Jeanette about that in a few minutes. Yeah. You know, I was thinking about this, John. I think you and I are the only ones old enough of the four of us to have actually seen it in the theater.
Yeah.
Do you remember? Do you remember that?
I do. I'm not a Jaws fan. I know I've seen it, but I can't quote chapter and verse about it like some people can.
I can't quote chapter and verse either, but I do remember that scene. Everybody's seen it, so I'm not spoiling anything. The scene where the boat and the head kind of comes like without the music. It's like, you know, yeah, scary. But and I'm sure Josh and Sam, you became Jaws fans, right?
I'm a huge Jaws fan.
Yeah,
I can quote it chapter and verse. And, you know, in the spirit of the islands always trying to one-up each other, Jaws may have been filmed on Martha's Vineyard, but Peter Benchley and his family have summered on Nantucket for generations.
Yeah.
So we're not doing quite as many celebrations, but we also will be screening, the Nantucket Film Festival will be screening the documentary Jaws at 50 as one of the centerpiece films next week at the Nantucket Film Festival.
All right. Oh, is that island competition going on, right? All right, Sam,
it premieres on the Vineyard this weekend, actually. So
okay.
We'll take it.
All right, Sam Houghton from the Martha's Vineyard Times, Josh Balling from the Inquirer Mirror, and CAI's John Basile. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up after break, we look ahead to the Cape Symphony's Jaws concert and plans to keep parties on some area beaches to a minimum over the 4th of July. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point. It's the News Roundup, where we look at the stories making news this week. And we may be one step closer to learning the fate of more than 800,000 gallons of radioactive water inside the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here with the latest on that. And she'll also talk about that new feature story about a special JAWS anniversary event in Edgartown. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Mindy.
The owner of Pilgrim is in the midst of a formal state appeal process seeking to discharge the water from the nuclear plant into Cape Cod Bay. So what's happening with that appeal?
Well, this appeal proceeds in a way that's very similar to a court case. It has hearings, and the hearings for that concluded last Friday afternoon. It was 2 days early, in a sense, because they had four possible days on the calendar for it, but that schedule is really just an estimate. So it doesn't mean that anything was cut short. They did get through all nine of the witnesses. Each side has a chance to cross-examine those witnesses, which they did. And the parties here are Holtec International, which owns Pilgrim, and the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection. They're the main parties, but actually the state has also given standing to two community groups and two towns, Barnstable and Plymouth, to participate in this case. And essentially the appeal again is that Holtec is appealing a decision by the DEP last year that denied them a permit, actually a modification of an existing permit, to release that water from the plant into Cape Cod Bay.
So what are the next steps on this? Do we know when that decision will be?
The next steps, the main one coming up right now is the closing arguments. So those were not part of the live hearing. They are expected to be delivered by video conference. The last time I checked on that, there had not been a date set for that, but the attorneys do have some time to prepare for it. And then once the closing is done, the adjudicator, who's actually called a presiding officer, that person has a certain amount of time to issue a decision. So we're still a couple months out, a few months out probably from a decision, but it's supposed to happen sometime this calendar year.
Right. So let's now turn to a feature story that you've been working on this week. It's a fun one. It has lots of music in it. It's tied to the 50th anniversary of JAWS. As we kind of hinted before, it involves the Cape Symphony, but this is not a traditional concert.
That's right. It's called JAWS in Concert, but it's much more than a concert because the Cape Cod Symphony Orchestra is going to be playing the full score live outdoors with a showing of the film in Edgartown. That is tomorrow night. It's actually kind of a big event with food. It's got souvenirs. It's got VIP tickets and the whole thing. But for our purposes, for our radio feature, we decided to explore the music itself that the symphony is going to be playing and what it's like to play live with a film. I just want to give a shout out to Fairhaven for folks on the mainland who may not be getting to the Vineyard tomorrow night. Fairhaven has an outdoor showing of JAWS on the same night, although that one does not have a symphony.
And I know you met with a couple of the musicians who are going to be playing tomorrow, and they played some of the music for you. Talk about what they had to say about it. This isn't as easy as just kind of, you know, following the score. It's a lot more complicated.
That's right. Yes. I met with Norma Kelly, who plays the cello, and Wendy Rolfe. Wendy's a flute player. She is actually going to be switching between three instruments, piccolo, flute, and alto flute. So she showed me a little bit of how those low notes on the alto flute can sound kind of mysterious, like you're underwater with the shark. And I did want to ask them about what you just mentioned there, the logistics of staying with the film. Wendy said that the conductor will probably have a laptop that shows the score and it kind of highlights where they are in the movie as the movie is playing to help them stay with it. Remember, they'll be in the dark. Mm-hmm. You know, they have lights, but they're in the dark. And there are sometimes long breaks where there's no music or where there might be a quick change of tempo and things like that. So it can be pretty tricky to stay with the film.
You talked with a professor of film scoring about this music. And it's interesting because you would think film scoring started with film, but it's really got quite an interesting history.
Yes. I talked with Tim Hewling. He is a film composer and also a professor at Berklee College of Music. He said this idea of not just repeating the motif, but also using it in different ways to create different effects in the storytelling was done in opera before the advent of the motion picture. And one way that he sees it being used in JAWS is that we hear that da-da, da da, right? Those two notes. And once the audience knows that that signals the approaching shark, then later in the film, John Williams can then use it strategically and actually at some points leave it out when the shark is actually approaching, because then it creates like some extra suspense. We're not sure if he's approaching or not, and then we're shocked. The audience is shocked when the shark finally does reappear.
Yeah, it happened to me for sure. All right, CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Thanks, Jeanette.
Thanks, Mindy.
Large crowds over the 4th of July have some thinking about safety. Chatham planning on closing some beaches early on July 4th. And joining us with that story is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. And we say early. Doesn't seem that early to me, Tim.
Yeah, it's only an hour early from the standard closing time of beaches. But the police chief here in Chatham, Mike Anderson, says that he thinks is just enough to deter, unregistered illegal beach parties from spilling over from other towns into Chatham.
Yeah, and when you think about that, it's not like back in the day, like you told all your friends, social media, you could end up with just hundreds of people, right?
Yeah, and they found that in the past couple of years. I'm sure you remember the year before last, I think Dennis had a big problem with parties at the beaches on 4th of July weekend or 4th of July holiday, and they ended up closing their beaches. Well, those people are going to go somewhere else, and they can easily tell all their friends where to go through social media.
Yeah,
it just takes one posting for hundreds of people sometimes to show up.
Yeah, I would also imagine too. You think about the crowds that we get. I don't know if this is just my observation, but it seems to me that 4th of July weekend is probably the busiest weekend with visitors of the entire summer, and the police departments are really they're stretched out. I don't think they get any time off on that weekend.
No, definitely not. Every member of at least at the Chatham Police Department, I know every member is working pretty much that whole weekend. And of course, this year it's a long weekend, so it's going to be likely even busier, according to town officials. They're really gearing up for a lot of people to be here.
Yeah, and you also have a story about banning inflated beach balls during the July 4th parade. What's that all about?
Yeah, so for about the past 15 years, a local clothing company, Mahi Gold, that's sort of been their standard 4th of July parade float in Chatham here, where they have just thousands of beach balls that they stuff into a truck, and then they give them out to people along the parade route. There's a parade committee in Chatham that runs our 4th of July parade, as well as the police department have been concerned about, beach balls blowing around, getting bounced out of the truck instead of handed out, which is the way they're supposed to do it. And, kids flock to this float looking for the beach balls, as you can just imagine. And they're really concerned that someone is going to get hurt, fall down. There's vehicles in the parade that may not be able to see them because they're large trucks. So initially, the parade committee decided to completely ban any sort of beach balls from the parade. But then they talked to Becky Vogel, who's the owner of Mahi Gold, and they reached a compromise where they'll have some inflated balloons on their float, but they're only going to hand out deflated balloons, which they think will, be less of an attraction for kids to sort of rush out to get. So it doesn't sound like much, but for Chatham, for the Chatham parade, this is going to be a big change.
And parents, get ready, because the kids are going, please blow this up for me, right?
Exactly. Get your lungs in
shape.
Order.
And we've also seen that change where they used to throw candy from the floats, and you haven't been able to do that for a while. Right now, they can only hand it out.
Yeah, it's part of the parade rules. They're supposed to hand out candy or flyers or whatever that they want to give out during the parade. That rule sometimes is honored more in the breach than in actuality. I've seen everything from, people tossing, foam foam frisbees or frisbees from trucks to people just sort of gently handing out little you know, coupons or cards or something like that. But they're going to be watching closely this year because they are really concerned about safety.
Yeah.
So if you're planning to be in the Chatham 4th of July parade and give anything out, make sure you hand it out.
All right. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Mindy.
The recent ICE raids have resulted in a lot of fear in our communities, and the New Bedford Light has been following up on those detained and deported on the South Coast. And joining us to talk about what's happening to the families' impact is Kevin Andrade. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So I just have to say, you and your colleagues have been doing such a great job covering this issue. And I feel like you guys get more information than many other media outlets. I'm not sure how you're doing that. But talk us a little bit about the follow-ups. What's interesting is that you have found that most of those detained have been men, but haven't really gotten the answer whether that's an actual strategy.
Right. So in New Bedford, since President Trump has returned to office, there has been somewhere between 38 and 41, 42 people detained. And as of right now, we are only aware of one woman, Judy Melissa Aguiriano Romero, that has been taken in. And what we have heard from activists and what many people on the street have told me and told them is they believe that it's a strategy to get the main breadwinners of the family, remove them, put the family in a position of financial peril or emotional and psychological distress, and get them to a point where they throw up their hands and say, you know what, I'm done. I'm moving back to Guatemala. I'm moving back to Honduras. I'm moving back to wherever. There's a sense in the community that this is very intentional and that it is meant to make people leave of their own accord.
Yeah. And these families left behind, they're really struggling. And you talk about it in your piece. They're behind on rent. They can't afford the basics. It's a really tough situation.
Oh, yeah. Many of the organizations, such as Centro Comunitario de Trabajadores, the CEDC, Immigrants Assistance Center, they've seen people... They've seen an uptick in people requesting food aid, diaper aid, financial aid. There's one family, the people left behind as a result of the Vile Street raid. Every single person in there is a teenager now after agents took the two adult males who were living with them. And those two men are now in Guatemala. And the entire household responsibility has fallen on a 19-year-old. So she's making sure that her 16-year-old brother and 16-year-old cousin go to their doctor's appointments. When they don't feel like going to school, they go to school. And she also, and this 19-year-old also had to learn how to handle health insurance. And there's another woman, her name's Juana. She's a Quiche woman. She doesn't speak Spanish. She ended up spending her family's savings, about $5,000, on lawyers for her husband, Miguel, after he was taken in by ICE and eventually deported in March. Now she's $3,000 behind in rent and facing eviction.
Yeah. And you mentioned that 19-year-old. I'm just saying that's so much stress on a 19-year-old and stress on anybody, no matter what age you are. This also has a lot of health impacts on these folks living under that constant fear and stress.
Oh, yeah. One person that we're aware of has developed chronic migraines after their husband was taken in during an operation. A teenager all of a sudden can't sleep unless he has somebody in the room and the lights are on because he's terrified that agents are going to pop in. Study after study has shown that each of these, that stress leads to the physical manifestation of physical symptoms such as these, and it also has a deleterious effect on other aspects of people's lives. Mm-hmm. We're also seeing, especially when raids happen, that there's a drop in school attendance. There's a recent study from the Annenberg Institute at Brown University that found that raids in the Central Valley led to a 22% Central Valley out in California led to a 22% drop in school attendance rates this year.
Wow. And speaking of that, more arrests early this morning.
Well, that was yesterday.
Oh, yesterday.
Yes. So there were 5 to 8 Mexican men pulled over in a white van. It looked like the type of construction van that you and I are used to seeing on the road go to from one site to another. And there's video on Facebook, just a black SUV with flashing lights and agents surrounding this van and taking these men into custody. Now, Corinne Williams, the director of the CEDC in New Bedford, said that these men don't appear to have deep roots in New Bedford. They appear to be recent arrivals. But the rumors spread quickly. I went to a nearby restaurant and everybody, and like, I didn't even need to ask anything. I heard everybody conversing about this raid that just happened. And those aren't the only story. Those aren't the only new detentions that I've picked up. There was a man picked up at sea. There was a Brazilian man picked up at a check-in on Sunday. And there was another man in Plymouth who lives in New Bedford who was picked up at a worksite in Plymouth yesterday morning.
Wow. And as far as you can tell from the ones that you've been following, do they have criminal backgrounds, criminal charges against them?
That's a complicated question. So, yes, they do, but they're often dismissed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of them don't. I'd say that most of the ones that I've seen don't have it.
Yeah.
And many of the ones that do, it's like we've seen domestic violence charges, we've seen OUIs, but they're often dismissed. One prominent case is the case of Rui Mures, who's a Portuguese man, got picked up at Logan Airport a few months ago. And he had a 2017 drug charge that was dismissed after he cooperated with authorities and program, and a 2017 OUI that he also cooperated with authorities with and got dismissed. So, you know, it's not that there's never been any police records among the victims, but I'm not really seeing any cases of murder.
It's no serious crimes.
Yeah.
All right, Kevin Andrade from the New Bedford Light. Kevin, keep up the good work. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Coming up, the possibility of an alternative treatment for Lyme disease. Stay with us. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. Lyme disease is one of the many diseases we humans can pick up from ticks, and treating it has mostly been with an antibiotic called doxycycline. But scientists are looking at an alternative. Ethan Gettner from the Vineyard Gazette joins us with that story. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning, Wendy.
So this would be another antibiotic?
Yeah, right now, researchers from Northwestern just put out a study earlier this spring that looked at 500 different FDA-approved compounds and seeing, you know, is there an alternative to doxycycline, which doesn't work for everyone and can leave some people with some stomach issues, among other kind of adverse impacts.
So one of the issues with Lyme disease, of course, is the difficulty in diagnosing it, right? So you want to try to avoid it. But a lot of times people, they get bit by a tick, or they think they've been bitten by a tick, and the doctors are prescribing this, as I mentioned, doxycycline, which can have a lot of side effects. It's a pretty heavy-duty antibiotic, right?
Yeah, and it's taken in heavy doses. And so the new one that they have hope for is called piperacillin, and it's in the penicillin family, and it's usually used for kind of very serious hospitalizations and infections. But what they found in testing in mice was a very low dosage, I think 100-fold less than what was used for doxy, worked and seemingly cured the mice of Lyme. And so they're trying to get this to go to a clinical trial to see, you know, will it have the same kind of effects with humans?
Yeah. And when you think about that, the long-term effects of Lyme disease are really tough. And the longer you wait, the harder it is to combat.
Yeah, I mean, it's here on the Vineyard, we have a major tick problem, and we have the highest rate of Lyme in the country. So a lot of islanders kind of follow very close, and they are working. Pfizer was working on a vaccine, but a lot of folks are saying, you know, we need to kind of combat this every which way we can. And, you know, if there is a new potential antibiotic that can help, let's go for it.
So this, as you mentioned, still in the research stage. It still would need to go through clinical trials. So how long might it be before this would be available?
I mean, it would probably be several years, if not. I mean, we're talking, yeah, like I said, we're looking in years, not anything shorter than that. And one of the issues right now is a lot of this kind of clinical trial studies are funded through NIH, which has been taking cuts under the current federal presidential administration. So it's unclear, you know, what the appetite is to fund these kind of research. So we'll see where it goes kind of from here.
So maybe in the meantime, permethrin, put on your shoes, your pants, preventative if you can.
Tick, permethrin, do it all.
Yeah.
You don't want to get, it's easier to prevent it than try and fix it later.
Right. All right, Ethan Genter from the Vineyard Gazette. Thanks so much, Ethan. Appreciate it.
Yep. Take care.
All right, there are a number of roadways that could be made a lot safer for pedestrians and bicycles, and the Cape Cod Commission is working on that. Paul Benson from the Provincetown Independent has that story. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Mindy.
All right, so you're taking your life into your hands on some of these stretches of roadways, right? There's some, especially with all the traffic we have.
Yes, and, you know, a lot of these roads go all the way back to the horse and buggy era. They're winding, they're narrow, they only have one lane each way, no shoulder. So there's not even, like, a margin to walk on. Sometimes you literally are walking in the lane.
Yeah. And we're supposed to be 4 feet as we pass a bicycle, right? 4 feet. And sometimes that's just not possible.
Right. You have to wait for oncoming traffic to stop, which means you're either riding behind the bicycle for a long ways and then looking for a gap in the cars. You know, you can't really pass the cycle safely unless there's no oncoming traffic on the other side of the oncoming lane.
Yeah. So the Cape Cod Commission is working on a multi-year plan to look into this?
Yes. So the commission doesn't own these roadways. Most of 6A that runs through Orleans, Brewster, Dennis, Barnstable into Sandwich and Bourne is owned by the state. There's also the stretch of 6A that is Shore Road in Truro and then Commercial and Bradford Street in Provincetown. And that's mostly owned by the towns, although the state owns about a mile of it.
And so what's the plan? We're in the first year right now. So what is it? Feedback at this point?
They're seeking a lot of public comments on what it is people want to see. Bike lanes, as they said, are controversial. Pedestrian improvement, definitely a lot of people are interested in. And they want to know, you know, the balance that people are looking for between what it means to improve a roadway and what it means that these are historic and you want to leave certain aspects of them. You know, Old Kings Highway actually has been historically protected since 1844, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. That in the early 1800s, it was already considered a historic place.
Yeah, so. That's crazy. So, yeah. And there was a meeting, right, at that Provincetown Town Hall where people were hearing from, you know, Provincetown Town residents were hearing what the plan might be. What is it to change the road, not change the road? What was the response to the folks who were there?
Right. So at this stage, they're gathering public comments. Over the winter, they're going to try to collate them into sort of the outlines of a plan, present that in the spring, see what the public thinks of the outlines of the plan, and then formalize that and send it off to the towns and the state and say, hey, this is what the public says they want. So they're starting a process that, you know, won't unfold extremely quickly. But, you know, once the state gets it on their agenda, they're like, okay, we'll finance this in our like 5-year plan. And they start rolling out these improvements over time.
So now's the time to get your to get your voice heard, right?
Absolutely. They have a really cool public comment portal, and I say that as a veteran of these kinds of things. It has lots of information about the roadway, the location of all the crashes, how the speed limit changes, exactly where the sidewalks are and are not. And finally, it shows the width of what the state and the town actually owns. So in Shore Road in Truro, it's a 23-foot wide roadway, but the town actually owns 50 feet. So like 11 feet on either side of the road is owned by the town, which when you drive around Shore Road and look at it, you're like, oh my gosh, there's light poles, there's hedges, there's all kinds of obstructions in those 11 feet on each side. But the town does own enough land to make a sidewalk if they wanted to.
Interesting. All right, Paul Benson from the Provincetown Independent. Paul, thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, this past weekend, New England state governors met with the premiers of 6 Canadian provinces here in Massachusetts. CAI's Gilda Geis spoke with our Statehouse reporter Katie Lannon to hear more about the summit.
Katie, this week you covered a summit that Governor Maura Healey convened with the leaders of 6 New England states and 6 Canadian provinces. So what was the intent behind holding the summit, and what did the day look like?
So the day started with kind of a private huddle where the governors, the premiers, the other officials and their staffs spoke to each other about what they're seeing, what they're hoping for, what they're feeling. And then they came out and greeted the press and had kind of a moderated discussion. It really does seem like one of the goals of this meeting was just to highlight the respect that these groups of officials have for each other and for the citizens of the of New England, of Canada, and their cultural bond between the regions. They are trying really hard to position that relationship as a contrast to the rhetoric you hear lately out of Washington, D.C. about Canada. And they want to remind people that the economies of the northeastern states, of eastern Canada, are really linked. They've worked together for a long time on issues like climate change, decarbonization. So they really do see the future of broadly this region as all intertwined.
After President Donald Trump's comments about wanting to annex Canada, it kind of seemed like some Canadians would be pulling back on visiting and spending money in the U.S. So what did the summit attendees have to say about the current state of Canadian tourism and spending in the U.S.?
That, at least in these northeastern states, it's down pretty significantly. That's including in New York City and across New England. And that is something that will, you know, have an impact on the tourism and hospitality industries here. You see up in Maine, there's a real big marketing campaign. The governor of Maine was holding up a sign that she's been putting up in businesses there that welcomes Canadians in both English and French. And they're looking kind of beyond that as well, not just tourism, but here in Massachusetts, the governor's worried about people from Canada who come to study and research in our institutions and teaching hospitals.
How were leaders at the summit talking about Trump's tariffs and the trade war?
They were describing the tariffs as a tax that will hurt the American economy. That's how they see it. They are hoping to see some sort of resolution come from the talks this week between Trump and the Prime Minister of Canada. They seem to be viewing this as something that is challenging in the short term that they hope everyone can get past and get the relationship back to normal with Canada and the U.S. as close neighbors and friends.
Any other moments or discussions that stood out to you while you were reporting on this?
Yeah, I think it was interesting that the Premier of Ontario pointed out that governors and premiers have massive influence in both Washington, D.C. and the Canadian capital of Ottawa. So it sounds like they are going to try to use that influence on U.S.-Canada relations. So this might not be the last we hear from this group.
That's Katie Lannon reporting from the State House. Katie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Katie Lannon with our Gilda Geist. And as we mentioned earlier in the program, this weekend marks 50 years since Jaws first opened in theaters in 1975. And tomorrow in Edgartown, the music from Jaws is in the spotlight as the Cape Symphony plays the score live during an outdoor screening of the film. CAI's Jeanette Barnes talked about that early in the program. We thought you might want to hear the piece. So let's take a listen.
Just the three notes, mostly the E and F, but sometimes there's a D thrown in. Just kind of making that sound, just a little bit of bow.
Norma Kelly of Hyannis. She's been playing her cello in the Cape Cod Symphony Orchestra for more than 40 years. For Jaws in Concert, the symphony will play the full John Williams score, including the recurring half-step motif that elicits a certain primal fear. In interviews, Williams has recalled the first time he showed Steven Spielberg what he had in mind. The two notes were so simple, Spielberg thought it was a joke. But add the rest of the orchestra, and you get this. The main notes are an ostinato, a rhythmic pattern that repeats throughout the score. It appears in songs named for the action on screen, like Barrel Off Starboard, and this one, Brody Panics. Creating a motif and using different versions of it to tell the story follows a musical tradition that predates film itself, says Tim Hewling. He's a film composer who teaches screen scoring at Berklee College of Music.
What comes from opera with composers like Wagner and others is the idea of developing music across the story in a way that connects to deeper structures of the story. Jaws is a great example of the composer kind of tricking the audience and manipulating the audience.
Once Williams has made it clear that the half step represents the shark approaching, he can choose key moments to leave it out.
And so we get this extra shock when the shark suddenly appears and launches itself at the boat, and we haven't heard the half step. So he's a real master at thinking across the entire film and the experience of the audience.
Of course, there's a lot more to the Jaws score than those two notes. Hewling says some parts sound more subtly uncomfortable, cold, or intriguing.
There are some other gestures that sort of sound like almost like an alert, like a reaction to the coming shark, the sort of da-da-da, like, uh-oh, what should we do?
Some of the more subtle moments in the score are supplied by the flutes and piccolos. That's Wendy Rolfe on piccolo in her living room in Marion. She plays flute in the Cape Symphony. For the Jaws score, her part involves switching between three flutes, the piccolo, standard C flute, and the alto flute, which plays lower notes. Sometimes she has just 5 or 6 seconds to switch instruments.
So you have that low, deep sound. You can think of the ocean.
When the symphony plays live with a movie, the conductor has to make sure they stay in sync. The music stops and starts, and the tempo can change suddenly. Rolfe says this takes some practice.
It's very interesting and pretty complex. Our conductor will be watching the score for the film on, I think, probably a laptop, and probably will have some kind of a earphone to show the tempos and what's going on or the speeds of the different sections in the film.
Conductors of film scores often hear a click track like this. Rolfe says it's hard to believe Jaws was written 50 years ago. With sharks returning to the Cape and Islands in big numbers, the film feels so current. She says one thing that's changed is us. People are learning to live with ocean predators.
And understanding that they need to make a living too by eating seals and things. We can also look back now and maybe be more sympathetic to the shark because we understand that the shark is really just trying to survive.
The Symphony Show is just one of countless events celebrating the 50th of everything Jaws, from the bigger boat to those two immortal notes. For CAI, I'm Jeanette Barnes.
Cape Symphony performing the Jaws score to the movie 6 p.m. tomorrow night in Edgartown. That wraps up this week's News Roundup. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.